something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hi, listener. I'm Carol Fisher, the host of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister. I'm so excited for you to hear the brand new season where we're uncovering a 35-year-old mystery. But for those of you who didn't hear season one or just want to listen to it again, you can now get access to all episodes of that first season of The Girlfriends 100% ad-free through the iHeart True Crime Plus subscription, which is available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. You'll also get access to every single episode of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, ad-free and 1 week early, only available to iHeart True Crime Plus subscribers. So what are you waiting for? Head to Apple Podcasts, search for iHeart True Crime Plus, and subscribe today.
Hey there. I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're coming at you with listener mail today. Now, our loyal mailbot, Carney, has been through some changes.
That's right. He's been off in Fatburg City. He's been helping Officer Fatburg battle the city's Fatburg problem.
That's right. And in the course of fighting a Fatburg, which of course turned out to be sentient and alive, I guess that goes without saying. You can't be sentient without being alive.
Right.
Can you?
But not for long.
Or maybe you can. Yeah, that's subject for another day. Anyway, like the black ooze in Prometheus, part of that Fatburg just got right on into Carney. It took over part of his processor. Now he's Fatburg inside, Fatburg power, Fatburg logic. And he's part Fatburg bot forever. Little flies come out of his nooks and crannies.
Oh, I think that's just temporary. I think this is going to be an equilibrium that is reached. And to whatever extent Carney can be fueled by Fatbergs, I think that's exciting. I think that's the future. That's actually going to be the topic of another episode we're going to be recording. I have an episode of Invention coming up. What happens when robots can eat Fatbergs?
Uh-huh.
We'll find out. But this episode is about listener mail, and we did receive a lot of really cool listener mail regarding our episode on Fatbergs. Now, just to refresh, to remove some of the sci-fi fun here that we've been throwing out for a second, a Fatberg is this large mass that accumulates in a modern sewer system, or even in kind of, I guess, an archaic sewer system, but due to modern sewage problems, mostly caused by the flushing or the dumping of grease and the flushing of sanitary wipes.
Wet wipes,
yes.
Primarily, yeah. Like 99% of the problem with the wipe things, or mm-hmm. these things that are wet wipes. And apparently we heard from a lot of listeners, even people who worked in, sewer maintenance, sewer workers, who said that these things that are so-called flushable wet wipes are not flushable. Don't flush them, even if they say you can.
Yeah. And, I have a kid. I've have used wet wipes plenty of times, and after you use them, you want to be rid of them. Mm-hmm. Being able to throw them into a magical vat of water and then pushing a button and watching it disappear, that's an attractive idea when you have a poop-smeared wet wipe. But it doesn't really disappear. It goes somewhere, and then it makes friends.
It becomes the bones of the soap dragon.
That's right.
So maybe we should get right to our first email. This one comes from Ray. Robert, you want to read this one?
Sure. Hello, Robert and Joe. My name is Ray, and I could not believe how close to home the episode of Fatbergs landed. I am currently a sewer utility worker in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And prior to serving in the Army for several years, I was a sewer utility worker in Jersey City, New Jersey. The issue of grease infiltrating our country's sewers seems to be almost a universal problem with no real end in sight. Although there are significant differences in the capacity and complexity between the two sewer systems I have personal experience with, the effects of grease and non-biodegradable solids, such as wet wipes and feminine hygiene products, seems to be universal. In my experience, I have seen and worked on many grease-related issues, and though I have seen some large blockages, the issues I have come to find most common are more like grease tubes. The initial blockage creates a type of grease dam, which in turn leads to the sewer pipe becoming completely impacted with grease. Picture this as a tube of toothpaste. These issues can run for hundreds of feet underground and can require days of work to clear. The comparison made in the articles you read about it and concrete cannot be more accurate. When trying to relieve a Fatberg-induced blockage, quote, chipping away at the grease gestalt monstrosity with mason tools is surprisingly effective and brings to mind archaeologists using picks and hammers trying to reveal the hidden past and secrets the Fatbergs hold in its subterranean lipid vaults.
That's good.
One point that I noticed was not mentioned that absolutely needs mentioning was the surprisingly distinct smell that grease blockages have, which, if one enjoys fried foods, could actually be appetite-inducing.
Huh.
Each of the several grease blockages I have dealt with had a smellscape that one could use to easily identify the main contributor to its unholy birth, whether it be pizzerias, Chinese food takeout, or even a rather famous diner located in downtown Jersey City. Nothing makes you look forward to lunch like the smell of comfort food wafting up from the depths of the sewer.
Oh, God.
Thank you again, guys, for never failing to surprise me with your awesome topics. This one in particular, Fatbergs, made me realize that even something as mundane sounding as sewer utility work can be interesting. As a final side note, I would often try and tell people how serious grease problems can be in sewers and how large and lengthy they could be. It reminded me of another episode of yours, Great Wave, in which stories would be told by wayward sailors, often describing waves whose proportions seemed drastically exaggerated. I feel a shared kindred with these sailors, knowing that grease abominations lurk below the streets, and those who I tell my tales to disregard them as exaggerated fantasy. LOL. Thanks again, Ray.
Well, we don't disregard them, Ray. We believe every word.
Yes.
Except I am a little skeptical about the appetite-inducing qualities of the sewer smell.
Well, I think we have some other listener mail that speaks to the odor, but I don't know. I can imagine. I mean, I trust Ray on the matter. I mean, he has experience that I do not have regarding
right.
Fatbergs and their unholy kin. So if he says there is an appetizing odor, then I believe it.
I guess what I mean is the only thing I doubt is whether it would be appetizing to lots of people or to everyone. That seems like it would probably vary person to person, especially depending on maybe your disgust reflexes and how sensitive they are.
Oh, you mean to fast food or to just in general?
No, I mean to general, like the association. I mean, we know a lot about how smell is in some ways cognitive. You know, mm-hmm. we've talked on the show before about how the exact same smell, if you're told it's a cheese, it smells good. But if you're told you're smelling socks and it's the exact same chemical stimulant, it's disgusting. It makes you, you know, you find it revolting. And I think the same thing would probably be true. You know, there are different levels of sensitivity, but like you can smell a smell that would maybe smell good if it's coming out of a restaurant kitchen. But if you smell it in a sewer, it might give you the gag reflex.
Right. But then if you're working in a sewer, like I don't know. It might turn things around. Like you're in there so long, exposed to this different smellscape,
mm-hmm.
and if there's a hint of something even that is, from beyond the sewer, then perhaps the human mind can latch onto that. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
There's also, if I remember correctly, in our past episodes about smell, we've discussed how, you know, how about good smells and bad smells, and about how bad smells can sort of fade into the background a bit while good smells remain in the forefront.
Hmm.
I believe I have that right. But at any rate, there's a lot going on when we perceive odors, like even very strong odors. You know, some may be de-stressed and others remain stressed. At least as far, you know, as far as our perceptions go.
Right, because there might be different adaptive reasons for the brain to remain aware of certain kinds of odors but not of others once you've initially smelled them.
Right, so maybe that would allow room for, like, the pleasing odor that is mixed in amongst the foul odors to sort of resonate more after a while. But this is just me guessing.
Does the Yankee Candle Company make a Fatberg candle?
I don't know, but we did discuss in that episode some of the possibilities of using Fatbergs for fuel.
Yeah. Well, we actually have a great piece of listener mail about this.
Oh, let's do it.
Let's see here. This is a short one. This comes from Damien. Damien, subject line, Fatbergs are real. Hello from Little Rock. Fatbergs, sweet Jesus, those things can ruin your life. My wife's grandparents had no qualms with pouring bacon grease down the sink. They had apparently been doing so for the last 70 years. A Reuter company worker that we hired told us that our pipes were worse off than a Waffle House.
Oh.
I dug up ancient clay pipes and they were packed with the same stuff that's clogging sewers worldwide. It's a soap-like material that is fairly stinky and very lightweight. I actually lit it on fire while it was still wet. I'll include the fire video and offer to send you a sample of the berg itself. If you want some, let me know. I love your shows. Keep it up. Damien. Okay, Damien, I don't think we need a sample of the berg, but I did watch the video. And dude, yeah, it's like a tiny grease fire in puck form. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I glanced at this video as well, and it is it's really flaming up there.
It's kind of making spitting sounds. That might have to do with water content or the fact that it's wet.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say don't send us a piece of Fatberg.
Let's leave that up to the stochastic gods of Fatberg fate.
Okay,
I think I'm going to do this next one here from our listener Joe. In fact. Hi, Robert and Joe. My name is also Joe, and I am a plumber that listens to your podcast. No, not that plumber. I live in the state of Alabama. I routinely listen to your podcast on my way to job sites. Having been a service plumber in the past, I have to tell you that Donnie Don't made me twitch a little. I think we started off the Fatberg episode with some don't do what Donnie Don't does.
Right.
Pouring duck fat down the bathtub and stuff. Joe continues, Donna Don't, who also flushes sanitary products and plants shrubs over the residential sewer line, would have made me twitch a lot more. I don't care if the packaging says flushable or not. Anything small enough to fit down a toilet is flushable. That doesn't mean you should flush it. I could flush 1 liter water bottles down some toilets or even a bucket full of golf balls. There are even some that I wholly believe could flush small children, but that does not mean it's a good idea. That being said, my city doesn't have a sewer system that you can walk around in as it's more modern. However, I do have some grease stories that may interest you. Oh, and old grease is the single worst thing to smell in plumbing, narrowly beating out old urine. You would think that it's the poo, but it's not. Of course, I haven't had the displeasure of cleaning the lines at a morgue or funeral home. I know some who have, and I will not regale you with those stories, I'm sure you can imagine. To preface these stories, restaurants are required to have a grease interceptor in their line going out, and they do just what the name implies. They intercept and hold the grease. However, in one case, that was overlooked by the city. When I was an apprentice, we received a service call to a dentist's office that was backing up with raw sewage. The building was roughly 10 feet above the city sewer, and it was also the lowest of the surrounding buildings. After confirming that the lines to the city sewer were clear, we decided to pop a manhole cover. The road's dirt and grime had sealed it down. This heavy cast iron manhole cover then proceeded to float, albeit briefly, on the flood of water, among other things that rose from the manhole. I then had to direct traffic away from this open manhole as we waited for the city's jet truck to come clear the line. I think the jet truck is like a high-pressure water. This was a very busy 4-lane road in the downtown of my city. I almost got run over several times as people swerved into the other lane within feet of me. I digress. When the truck arrived, the 12-inch city main was blocked for 200 feet by, you guessed it, Fat in Greece, where this restaurant's line joined the city's. They had been pouring all of their oil down the drains. On another note, as an apprentice again, I have personally stood on one foot on top of hardened grease in an interceptor at another restaurant. The grease was about a foot thick and weighed about 200 pounds at the time, and it did not give. We had to take a steel bar to it to break it up so that it could be pumped out. I wouldn't say that it's as hard as concrete, but still rock-like. I'm looking forward to more awesome episodes from you guys. Joe.
All right. Another field report from the war against the Fatbergs.
That is an epic tale of a heroic struggle. I wish I only had the mind of a Homer to translate it into poetry. But one thing we did in that Fatberg episode is we proposed a movie crossover, which would be Fatberg Cop.
Yes. And yeah, Officer Fatberg. Yeah.
So we asked if anybody out there is, developer in Hollywood or anything, get Fatberg Cop going. We did hear back from a couple of people, a couple of creative types who engaged with Fatbergs one way or another. We heard from one listener named Tom who shared with us a story he had written about a Fatberg that becomes sentient. This was independent of our episode. He'd already written it in the past. But we also heard from our listener, L. Robert, do you want to read this one?
Yes. L writes, quote, "I recently listened to your episode on Fatbergs. You had mentioned how it would be cool to create an artist rendition of an anthropomorphic, murderous, and justice-seeking Fatberg. Well, being an artist myself, I could think of nothing more than to do just this. I wanted to make the creature humanoid, but also not too human. I ended up with some sort of lizard man cop made of congealed grease, and it turned out more sane than I would have liked. Make of that what you will. Maybe Fatberg really is the hero. Nevertheless, I enjoyed making this 80s-style poster art. Robert had mentioned never visiting Philly. Well, come on by. I can't recommend it enough. Also, I recently visited the Mütter Museum the week before the episode." This is, of course, the museum with all sorts of cool medical oddities, I guess you'd say. Yeah. Medical...
anomalous medical history.
Grim artifacts of medical history, etc. I've long wanted to visit there and just never have had the chance.
It came up in the episode because we were talking about the process of saponification, where lipid and fatty acids can turn into soap-like substances. And one example is a thing that's within the Mütter Museum's collection, the Soap Lady, and I think also a male corpse, the Soap Man, which are covered in this soap-like material called adipocere that's formed out of the lipids and flesh as it decays in certain types of environments, I think like alkaline environments.
All right, L continues. "I was looking for something to do with friends while nearby, though sadly not knowing what I was getting myself into. Listening to your description of the Soap Lady instantly brought a haunting image to my head of the corpse that visitors are greeted with as they enter the main room." The main room of the Mütter Museum. Mm-hmm. At least I think it was. I wasn't going to stick around to read the description. As soon as I realized what I got myself into, I tried to leave as soon as I could. Although I can see its importance as medical history and its importance for research, the idea of dead body and fetuses on display just didn't settle well with me. Not to say others would have a different experience. At the very least, it was a unique experience. I attached the work of Officer Fatberg below. I loved listening to your episode, as I always do, and I loved listening to your show every time I drive or commute. Keep it up, L from Philly." Okay, so for starters, this art that L gave us is tremendous, and as of this recording, I've requested that we be allowed to share this with the world on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. So hopefully that'll be the case, and you all can go check it out for yourself. It's pretty fun. It's reminiscent of things like Maniac Cop and so forth. And then secondly, I have to admit that I can, as interested as I am in visiting the Mütter Museum, I can imagine it's not everybody's cup of tea and not necessarily everybody's cup of tea every day.
Right.
Like some of my interests run or have run darker or more morbid at times, but there are days where I do not want to see a soap person or or some sort of pickled remains. I mean— for instance, I just watched, this is completely off topic, but I just watched The Deathly Hallows Part 1 last night.
Harry Potter?
Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 last night with my family. And the film was a lot darker than I remember it being, to the point where I felt kind of bummed out and depressed after finishing it.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if my tastes have just changed a lot. recently, but it's like that was just, it was, that was too dark of a film for me yesterday.
Is Deathly Hallows the last one?
It's the first part of the last one. It's the penultimate movie in the Harry Potter sequence of films.
Okay.
So it does have kind of ultimately an Empire Strikes Back kind of ending, because it's like all these terrible things that are happening, mm-hmm. and all these trials that the characters are put through. And it's a great movie, don't get me wrong. I think it's a tremendously impressive what they did with it, and I love Harry Potter as much as anybody. But whew, that one, I felt like it really put me through the ringers. So there are days when I am not in the mood for the darkness of a Harry Potter film. There are days when I'm definitely not in the mood to see a human cadaver that has been partially turned into soap.
Fair enough, Robert. I will never try to force you to go look at the soap lady if you're not feeling it.
Right. And if somebody sends us a fat bird chunk, you know, maybe it'll be the day when I'm totally up for looking at it. Maybe it'll be a day when I just need to, ask you to keep the bag closed.
Okay, I think we need to take a quick break, but we will be right back.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh, my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And, of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season three of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots. the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So Carney has given us the sign that we need to move on from Fatbergs.
Okay.
He is full of Fatbergs. He's currently processing it, digesting it, turning it into energy. So we're going to move on to some other episodes that we did, some listener feedback on them, particularly our episode concerning the fundamental attribution error.
Right. Now, this was a while back, so we did some messages about this on the last listener mail episode, but I think this one came in since then. This is from our listener, Matthew. Matthew says, "Greetings. So I am eagerly awaiting tonight's finale episode of Game of Thrones. It is one of the few shows or movies that I value experiencing along with the rest of the world. This last season has been taking a lot of flack from online critics, and I myself have felt the decline in quality. While thinking through the seasons and talking to my wife, I came to the conclusion that it was mainly because of characters acting out of their expected behaviors as established over the past seven seasons. Having listened to your recent cast on fundamental attribution error, I began to think about the story's players on a grander scale, about the society and why the characters within that society are acting the way they are, as opposed to out of solely personal motivations. It made me feel so intelligent when I came across this article by an actual smart person discussing this very subject with direct references to fundamental attribution error. Basically, the show's focus switched from a broad society-based story where something like the death of a main character progressed the narrative for everyone else," and he says that that's more in line with George R. R. Martin's novels. "And it switched to an individual focus narrative where each character's own psychology is being explored, which is the Hollywood screenwriter's more common approach. Thank you for equipping me to think about even mundane things like TV shows about dragons on a deep, almost academic level. Keep up the good work. Invention is awesome. You guys have long been the first thing I look for in my new releases list each week. Matthew." And Matthew links to this article he's talking about. And this is one I'd seen shared around a while, but I actually didn't read it until just today. It's an article in Scientific American by Zeynep Tufekci, who's a really good writer. I'd seen it going around, but I'm glad I read it because I think I pretty much agree with it about 100%. It's very spot on in analyzing how the show's storytelling mode changed over time, especially after the show ran out of book material to work with.
Yeah.
And the essential idea is that in the books, characters are hugely driven by circumstances, by, you know, the sort of like social pressures on them and the norms they face and by, you know, events outside their control. And we constantly see characters having to deal with all of these circumstantial pressures, and we understand the influence of circumstantial pressures. And after the book material ran out and the showrunners were more out on their own, it started to feel more like a typical Hollywood screenplay where like characters have like a main defining personality attribute and everything they do is pretty much in line with that main personality attribute.
Yeah. Yeah, this is interesting, especially, you know, coming from HBO. And granted, these were different showrunners, but I feel like The Wire, for instance,
yes,
did a great job of really – I think throughout the series, like focusing on the societal pressures that are making people what they are. Yeah, I mean, David Simon in interviews has talked about, you know, like in his work, especially in The Wire, like the gods of this Greek tragedy are, instead of it being like Zeus and Poseidon and so forth, they're institutions.
Yeah,
it's government, it's law enforcement, whatever the particular institution is that is applying this pressure to populations, to individuals. And I feel like that sort of thing is more evident in the earlier seasons of Game of Thrones, and then almost completely gone in the later seasons, the last couple of seasons particularly.
Yeah, and actually Zeynep Tufekci makes exactly that comparison to The Wire.
Oh, she does. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, and I think The Wire is a great example of that. A lot of the great shows are like that in a way, even though it's more focused on individual psychology, but even The Sopranos is kind of like this. Yeah. It has a sociological kind of feel. There are large movements and pressures and trends at play, and characters you constantly see characters struggling with their circumstances and being moved by them, and not just like acting out their dominant personality traits.
Right. You know, I do not want to make it sound like I am attributing Hollywood with all of society's woes or blaming superhero movies in particular, but I think it is worth noting that, you know, certainly Matthew here mentions the Hollywood screenwriter approach.
Yeah.
And that being focused on individuals. And of course, Hollywood is epicenter for our focus on celebrities, to focus on these key individuals that we've singled out for deification and vilification.
Mm-hmm.
To lift up and to sacrifice as need be to satiate our need for some sort of vicarious experience, and I wonder, you know, what the dangers are in putting that much cultural power within a single single system.
Yeah. Well, especially one that, as we talked about in the episode, is very often given to the fundamental attribution error. I mean,
right.
Like, I think a lot of, especially the weaker, shallower kinds of, you know, popular Hollywood storytelling very much fall into the FAE kind of category where mm-hmm. characters' behaviors are almost entirely explained by their, like, innate qualities and predispositions. And there's really not much attention paid to, like, broader trends and societal pressures and circumstances that change the way people are.
Right. And with superheroes, I want to stress that I enjoy superhero movies, and I'm not meaning to criticize them just across the board, but superhero movies are movies about individuals that are essentially gods.
Mm-hmm.
They may have flawed characteristics and even very, very human characteristics in some ways, which can of course be very much in keeping with classical treatments of gods. But they are individuals that apply pressure more to society, or seem to be completely removed from societal pressure in some cases,
mm-hmm.
and. When those are the dominant stories that we're telling, those are the ones that seem to have the most cultural impact, and certainly have the most box office impact. Does that just serve to help reinforce the fundamental attribution error in our popular storytelling?
I think that you could very well make that case. I think that's likely true.
That being said, I may be missing some really key examples of. Of films, particularly non-Hollywood films, but maybe some big tent pictures as well that run counter to this. So I would love to hear from listeners who have some really good examples of films that avoid the fundamental attribution error.
I think there's one reason you more often see like non-FAE storytelling and more like sociological or circumstance-based storytelling in longer television series, mm-hmm. And that's just like having to do with the efficiency of storytelling and runtime.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell a story that's not a little bit given to the FAE in a short runtime.
Right.
Because you need to identify themes really quickly and identify who characters are in a memorable way really quickly. You don't have whole seasons to figure out who people are and get a sense of them.
Oh, yeah. Well, like with The Wire, for instance, they had the time to provide characters and primary and secondary characters at all levels of society.
Yeah.
So you had, you had people on law enforcement side, people that were in the criminal element, in the sale and the trafficking of drugs,
mm-hmm.
but then also the political spectrum, the educational spectrum, and they were able to layer on more from season to season to provide this overall, ultimately holistic picture of how the world worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and doing that kind of thing, you need time to do that, and it's really hard to tell a story that appropriately treats the influence of circumstances and all that without doing something like that. So yeah, I can see why this kind of storytelling shows up more often on like the gold standard TV series than it does in movies.
Yeah. Yeah, because ultimately, if a movie can basically cover the ground of a short story is going to be limited generally to like one POV. Like there's not a lot, there's generally not much room for anything beyond that. All right. Well, speaking of created worlds, we have a correction here. This one comes to us from Steve. Was this a previous listener mail episode we were talking about?
Yeah, I think it was on the last listener mail episode we did. Somebody wrote in with an email that incorrectly attributed the author of a story, and we did not catch that.
Right. So anyway, Steve writes in and says, on your recent listener email, it was slated that John Scalzi wrote The Forever War. That is incorrect. Joe Halderman wrote The Forever War, which, this is correct. The author of The Forever War is Joe Halderman.
Okay, we stand corrected.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and I've read The Forever War, so I should have remembered that one. But at any rate.
Stuff goes by really fast while we're sitting here talking.
All right. Here's another one. This one comes to us from Chris regarding our Almost Cannibals episode.
Okay.
Which was, a contemplation of, how do we classify things that are not quite cannibalism in the animal world and occasionally in the human world? They're not quite cannibalism, but they're almost cannibalism. It's like almost
close
like,
in one way or another.
Like pre-cannibalism, right?
Yeah.
So Chris writes in and says, hey, checking in on a couple of recent episodes from Stuff to Blow Your Mind and Invention, and boy, do I have a crossover story for you. In your recent episode on Almost Cannibals, you mentioned a story about an army roasting meat and eating in close proximity to fallen soldiers from an opposing force. And this, by the way, this was like an older, attributed detail from history that, was probably rolled out as a way to criticize the enemy and make them seem more barbaric.
Uh-huh.
As if to say, just look at these people. They're not cannibals yet, but they're just like just one stumble away from it. Anyway, it continues. And that there were rumors that the army were cannibals because of this. Well, my story is about my grandfather, who was in the 95th Infantry Division during World War II. And he includes a short link to a video about them. He says he earned his nickname during the war as the Buzzard, as an unfortunate part of his job was to remove bodies from the field and take them off the trucks when they returned to the base. The moniker the Buzzard was applied because he was known to pull bodies from the truck with one hand and have a ham sandwich in the other.
Whoa.
It's amazing what the human mind can normalize during the horrors of war. I am by no means insinuating that he was a cannibal, but the bit about eating too close to dead bodies sparked a memory. The second tie-in comes once he returned home. My grandparents' house was three blocks from our small town, 1,500 to 2,000 people, funeral home. Here is where the camera comes in. We recently did a whole slew of episodes of Invention about the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Once he came back from the war, he would go to every wake where the person was laid out at the funeral home and take a picture of them in the casket. You mentioned in the episode on the camera about how early photography was used to document deceased relatives. He would then develop the film and annotate the back of the photograph with name, date of birth, death, etc. And all the photos would be out in albums. When he died, he had dozens and dozens of albums filled with these photos.
Wow.
He never talked about the war or really anything much, but I have to imagine that what he saw while serving changed the way he viewed life and death, and his photographs of those who had died were his own way of remembering them. Cheers, Chris.
Wow. Well, that's an interesting story. I don't know what to make about that, but thank you for sharing, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very strong point about the horrors of war. I mean, a lot of us, maybe most of those listening to us, we're far removed from those horrors. Certainly we do hear from time to time from individuals who've served in combat situations or in law enforcement environments or in some way or another have had this level of violence impact their lives. But for a lot of us, we are removed from it. So, we don't know what it's like to have to haul dead bodies around and at the same time deal with the fact that you have to eat. You have to have a sandwich and
right.
Maybe you do have a sandwich in one hand. And then likewise, when it comes to just dealing with death, I mean, I'm wondering about this case with the grandfather too, like being an older individual, like perhaps they had memories of a time when there was more photography, funeral photography taking place and, therefore, they're just kind of returning to those memories and doing it themselves.
Hmm.
I don't know, but yeah, this is certainly all food for thought.
So it looks like we need to move on to the next group of listener mail. This was in response to our episode against the phrase survival of the fittest in the context of explaining how evolution works. And so we got some responses just to the episode in general, and we got a number of responses, some mega responses to Pokemon, which, Robert, oh, yes. I think you brought up at the end of the episode.
Right, yeah. I mean, part of it just is because I'm too old for Pokemon, so I never did anything with Pokemon, so I don't have an appreciation for it. But I realize, you know, just from being online, that it is really important to many people, and that Pokemon becomes like a metaphor for understanding various things in life. And so it made me curious about, well, how does that play into understandings of evolution? Is it helpful? Is it a hindrance, et cetera? Mm-hmm. And so we put that out to listeners to chime in.
We heard from a lot. Well, I think maybe we should do a general email about the episode first, and then we'll do the Pokemon one.
Okay.
Okay, so this first one comes from our listener, Lloyd. Lloyd says, "Hi, guys. Love your podcast. I listened with interest to your episode on natural selection and survival of the fittest. I agree with your point that the latter phrase is not linguistically apt when a modern semblance of the phrase is applied. However, I wondered if this overlooks the fact that fittest may have had a slightly different meaning at the time when Spencer, Wallace, and Darwin were discussing it. You considered fittest to mean the biggest and the strongest, as in the bigger batterism you talked about. However, the word fittest literally means the best fit, most fit, or most suitable. Fit has only recently come to mean physically fit and has in the past meant something more akin to suitable, as in the phrase, this man is a fit and proper person. Mm-hmm. In your podcast, you also considered survival to mean survival of the individual. However, it also means survival of the species. Considered this way, survival of the fittest means survival of the species best fitted, or you might say most suitable to its environment. I therefore find myself agreeing with Wallace to some extent that it is a good and in some senses better descriptor of the evolutionary process than the phrase natural selection. I would suggest that the better argument for use of the term natural selection is that it suggests a kind of positive advancement or natural refinement. By contrast, survival of the most suitable or the fittest draws on the more nihilistic side of evolution, that those who are not the most suitable are destined to decline. That is, of course, true, but it's pretty depressing. Yours faithfully, Lloyd." Well, Lloyd, I mean, I think I accept a lot of the sense of what you're saying. I mean, what you're describing is, I think, how Darwin and Wallace and Spencer meant it, as we discussed in the episode. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think they were saying anything incorrect when they used the phrase. We were talking more about the modern implications that people get from the baggage of these words, not right. that like Darwin and Wallace were incorrect in how they used it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the words can change over time, or at least they can skew different directions, and then we have to account for that.
Also, words tend to, I mean, when there's a phrase like natural selection or survival of the fittest, we have to deal with the fact that in Darwin's context, this is a phrase that's appearing within a book, you mm-hmm. know, so he's got a whole book to explain what he means.
Right.
But these phrases now are just sort of floating free within the culture, and they're, you know, people invoke these phrases to explain how evolution works, but they might not necessarily bring with them all of the explanation that comes, like, say, in On the Origin of Species. So you don't have a book in front of you all the time. You have to think about how phrases are just received in a vacuum.
All right. Well, here's one of the Pokemon responses. This comes to us from Taylor. "Hey, Robert and Joe. Taylor here, another longtime fan and email writer. When Robert asked the audience to reach out with their Pokemon experiences at the end of Against Survival of the Fittest, it was a bespoke question for me. As a student of evolutionary biology and one of the biggest Pokemon nerds you'll ever meet, I couldn't resist saying everything I could."
All right.
So let's get right to it. When a Pokemon, quote-unquote, evolves within the context of the game, it matures into a larger, more powerful form and benefits from increased combat stats. While this might look like a terrible case of bigger batterism on the surface, the Pokemon franchise approaches adaptation and biodiversity with much more nuance than you might expect. While the game uses the term evolution to describe this growth, it's clear within the context of the game that Pokemon evolution is descriptive of a Pokemon species maturation and natural life cycle, and not of natural selection. This distinction is especially clear when Pokemon evolution represents the metamorphosis of a species. For example, when the larval Pokemon Weedle evolves into the pupate Kakuna before emerging as the wasp-like Beedrill at the end of its life cycle, or when the tadpole-like Dratini matures into the dopey amphibian dragon Pokemon called Dragonite. But wait, there's more. The Pokemon games also do a great job of describing symbiotic relationships, sexual dimorphism, and yes, even natural selection. Many Pokemon species exhibit important symbiotic relationships. For example, the seafaring manta-like Pokemon Mantine is rarely depicted without a remoraid.
I like that. It's like the Gatorade of remoras.
Yeah, that would be, I guess, it's, yeah, the genesis there. Clinging to its underside. As you might have guessed, their relationship is illustrative of the real-life symbiosis of remoras and open-ocean predators like blue sharks.
Hmm.
A lot of Pokemon also exhibit sexual dimorphism. One of my favorite examples is Burmy, a Pokemon based on real-life bagworm moths. Like their real-world counterparts, Burmy build protective cloaks around themselves out of whatever detritus is available to them. If you encounter Burmy within a forest, it is covered in leaves, whereas a desert-dwelling Burmy would be covered in sand and pebbles. But it gets more interesting. Female Burmy exhibit neoteny. They evolve into Wormadam, a larger bagworm Pokemon that remains sessile. But male Burmy evolve into Mothim, a flying insect that can flit from female to female. Another great example is the grouse-like Pokemon Unfazant, whose males boast resplendent plumage that the drab females lack. And Pokemon doesn't leave other examples of adaptation untouched. Several species illustrate coevolution, as is the case with Heatmore and Durant. Heatmore is an anteater Pokemon whose lava-hot tongue allows it to bore through the metal exoskeleton of the insect Durant. The franchise is explicit in describing this predatory relationship's role in the evolution of both Heatmore's tongue and Durant's metal shell. Finally, the most recent generation of the games, Pokemon Sun and Moon, introduced regional variants. Sun and Moon take place on the Polynesian-themed islands of Alola. Regional variants represent Pokemon species that have been introduced to Alola from elsewhere in the Pokemon world and have adapted to life on the islands. For example, the armadillo-like Sandshrew and its mature form, Sandslash, are usually encountered in desert biomes. But in Alola, their regional variants have adapted to frigid mountain caves and boast thicker bodies. Ultimately, Pokemon is a fantastical game. While I've put forth plenty of fascinating biology on display in the Pokemon world, there are still other Pokemon based on ghosts, golems, and inanimate objects, which may be unsurprising because of its Japanese origins. Nevertheless, I think it does a fantastic job of illustrating biodiversity and the mechanisms that relate to it. The Pokemon games shouldn't be a child's textbook for evolution, but for this childhood Pokemon fan become biologist, they played an extraordinary role in falling in love with the natural world. Cheers, Taylor. P.S. I highly recommend looking up images of the Pokemon I've described here because their designs are simply delightful.
Let me show you my Pokemans. Thank you so much, Taylor. You know what? You've brought me around. Yeah, I am not a Pokemon nerd like you. I did not ever really get deep into Pokemon. I think the deepest I ever got was when that original Game Boy game came out. I played it, but I never finished it.
Oh, yeah. I think I played when that phone game came out recently that was all the craze where you find Pokemon on the streets.
That had people wandering around waving their phones at stuff.
Yeah, I checked that out of curiosity, and I think I encountered a Pokemon in my house, and then I saw one down the street, and then but that was it. Uh-huh. But I appreciated what seemed possible with that game.
Did that game not turn out to be a massive data mining operation?
I don't know. I have friends who I think still play it, still really into it, and they enjoy going on walks and even trips and searching for Pokemon while they're out there. So I don't know.
I got to look into that more. But anyway, you've brought me around on the basic Pokemon concept. I love the Pokemans now. And you know what? Some of the illustrations are really great. You got me there.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take one more break. But when we come back, we will leave the realm of Pokemon behind and we will venture to the Holy Mountain.
Hey, girlfriends. It's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do.
Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season three of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
All right, we're back. So this is a straggler email that came in, I think, after the last batch that we read about Sacred Mountains. And this is from our listener, Dave. Dave writes, hi, Robert and Joe. Medium to long-time listener, first-time writer, I'm a big fan of your podcast and your new one, Invention. I'm writing in regard to the two episodes focused on Sacred Mountains. I live in the Pacific Northwest, and I'm an amateur mountaineer. I wanted to share a couple of things with you that you were curious about from your listeners. First, I've experienced altitude sickness a few times, but the worst of it was when I summited Mount Whitney in California, the tallest peak in the country within the contiguous United States at 14,505 feet. My partner and I were hiking the Pacific Crest Trail in 2016 from Mexico to Canada. We had stopped off to meet my mom and toured around Las Vegas, the Eastern Sierra, and Death Valley National Park. So we went to Death Valley, which has the lowest point in the U.S. at 279 feet below sea level. 3 or 4 days later, we were back on the trail in the heart of the Sierra and summited Mount Whitney. We had lost all of our altitude acclimatization since we took a break, and it was certainly felt. I made it up the summit relatively fine, slowly moving to some degree. Then, on the way down, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I could barely move, had the worst migraine I'd ever had, and was completely disoriented. I felt like I was going to explode at both ends constantly. Eventually, I made it to camp at about 8,000 feet and recovered over the next 12 hours. I drank plenty of water, ate, and slept. After that, I was more or less back to normal. Secondly, you'd both mentioned when researching the episode you didn't come across any evil mountains, really. When I was listening, one popped into my head that I find fascinating. According to the Native American tribe the Klamath, the good god is Mount Shasta in Northern California, and the evil god was Mount Mazama in Central Oregon. Apparently, 8,000 years ago, the two gods had an awesome battle, and ultimately the good prevailed. This resulted in Mount Mazama exploding and collapsing in on itself, and then creating the clearest and cleanest lake in the world, Crater Lake, which is an amazing place to go to if you've never been. Crater Lake is definitely worth the trip. David says, keep doing what you're doing, love your stuff, and he also attaches a photo of himself on Mount Whitney. He says, quote, before my world crashed in on me. Well, thanks, David.
All right. Here's another one that comes into us, and this one, no one ever has to use their real name when they write in, and this particular individual wrote in as Daddy. So, at any rate, this is what Daddy had to say. Dear Robert and Joe, I've been listening to your show for the last few months, and I would like to say thank you. You have provided me with such nutritious brain food. I have been binging on episodes while working out in the fields. Mostly I sit cross-legged planting vegetables. While the setting is quite peaceful, the labor is quite monotonous. Listening to your podcast has prevented my mind from turning into mud. I have so many compliments and comments about various topics you discussed, but it would make for quite the read. To save time, I have narrowed it down to a list of three. Number one, you both have such great taste in film. Well,
many would disagree.
Arguable, I guess, but I'm glad we see eye to eye. He continues, I was so excited when I started listening and discovered that many of the tapes you discuss I own on VHS because it's the only way to go.
All right.
Also, films you have mentioned that I haven't seen, I now have to thank you also for the recommendations. Then number two, The Cube.
Oh.
The 1997 film would make for a killer episode. Not only could you explore the science behind such a structure, I was reminded of the Library of Babel, but the themes submerged in the film would also provide quite the thought adventure. Have you seen Cube or any of its sequels, Joe?
Yeah, it's been a while. I remember it was a movie that definitely held my attention, but was also kind of bad.
Yeah, I remember, I think I watched it like on the Sci-Fi Channel on a Sunday afternoon, sort of a thing. And I remember being intrigued by it because it does have an intriguing concept. It has certain Kafka-esque elements to it, you know, where people are trapped in this machine that is lethal and full of lethal traps, but they don't know why they're in it or what purpose it's serving. And I think it's also, you know, it's stated or implied that, like, the people who made it were working on different parts of it and had no idea what the complete whole was.
Yeah, I think one of the guys in the cube, it turns out, like, helped build it, but he didn't know what it was going to be.
Yeah, and I think, like, some of those ideas are very thought-provoking. It gets into, you know, ideas of the panopticon and, modern society itself. And in a way, like the Cube movies, or at least the first one, you know, is kind of a predecessor to the Saw movies.
But yeah, kind of like elaborate traps and stuff.
But yeah. I feel like the elaborate traps were more the Cube setup for the elaborate traps, I think I far prefer than just like crazy serial killer with way too much time on their hands.
We got another exquisite movie recommendation coming next, though.
Oh, yes. Number three, Zardoz. It was somewhat offhandedly suggested by Joe in an episode. I cannot remember which, but yes, please, perhaps you can break the tabernacle.
What did I say about Zardoz?
I don't remember.
Did I suggest Science of Zardoz?
Maybe you did, because we were probably talking about Highlander or Highlander 2. I've actually never seen Zardoz. It's
Whoa!
I know, I've never checked it out.
Whoa! This is a game changer. Robert, would you like to see Sean Connery with a long braided ponytail and a red diaper and a mustache?
Absolutely, I would, especially if there's some sort of weird flying heads going on.
Yeah, there's weird flying heads.
That's all I know about it, but those two elements alone are enough to get me there. Didn't somebody interesting do the music? Is there something about the music I should be aware of?
Music was, I think it was directed by the same guy who made Deliverance. very, very strange movie.
Anyway, I think both of those sound like solid suggestions. I think we have yet to do so we've been doing these movie episodes where once a month, generally, we'll pick a movie and we'll use it as an excuse to, you know, talk about topics we've discussed before, but in light of the film, or as a way to talk about topics that might not otherwise come up on the show in their own episode. And generally, there's some sort of a, you know, approach to be made there. We've talked about stuff like 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Dark Crystal. We've talked about Highlander 2. Mm-hmm. We've talked about Silent Running. Am I missing one in there?
I don't know. Maybe.
Maybe, yeah. At any rate, it's a fun exercise, and we're hoping to continue doing it, and it's and we enjoy hearing recommendations from folks. Maybe one day we'll cover a movie that came out in the last couple of decades. We seem to be, narrowing in on, like, what, the 60s, 70s, and 80s thus far.
Why would we change that?
Yeah, it's a golden age, right? But it's not just old media that we talk about on this show. We also talk about new media. We also talk about social media.
Oof.
And that can sometimes be quite a doozy.
Social media is certainly, it is the Cube and the Zardoz of our world. it's the Tabernacle, it's the Cube Maze,
really,
it's all those things.
The Cube, actually, that whole scenario we just talked about people creating this thing, working on their individual corners of it.
It's a giant murderous weapon full of traps.
Yeah, and ultimately making a giant murder machine. I think there are a lot of comparisons to be made between that and various big-name social media platforms,
mm-hmm.
Which I think we'll be exploring in greater detail in subsequent episodes of the show. But we have been discussing aspects of it already.
Yeah, well, let's talk about some listener feedback to the episode we did about the Doppelganger Network, where we discussed the idea, of course, of doppelgangers and all that. But then also we discussed an article by Robert Sapolsky, the neuroendocrinologist, where he made a connection between the psychological syndrome known as Capgras delusion, where people tend to believe that the people they know have been replaced by imposters or doubles or doppelgangers, that and the kinds of psychological effects that are brought about by social media. And the main comparison he makes is that social media may be causing a similar kind of situation of recognition without familiarity and its inverse. So one of the things we talked about in that episode, of course, is, you know, often Robert and I, especially lately, we will tend to gripe about the evils of social media. And we talked about the possibility of, could anything be improved if you just took the corporate influence out of it and just had, like, nonprofit open source social media platforms?
Mm-hmm.
I do want to reiterate my feeling that even if we took the corrupting influence of the profit motive out of these platforms, I'm still not sure they'd be a good thing. I think it's highly possible they could still overall, like, even a nonprofit open source Facebook might be a bad thing for the world.
Right. And I also want to drive home, to come back to the Cube scenario, is that a lot of the people that we've been reading on this topic, like, they're not saying that there is, Jaron Lanier uses the exact phrase, and he says that he doesn't believe that, say, at Facebook, that there's a room, there's like an evil room in which an evil person plots out evil things for this particular company.
No.
That it emerges more like the death machine in Cube.
Yeah.
Where a company's trying to do various things, and some of those things may be quite noble, or at least have noble ambitions to them. Other things have far more corporate leanings, and all of these things, like, come together in the bake in the alchemy of a major corporation, and then the results may not be the best for us.
Yeah, and so it's, there's no guarantee all of these negative effects that we associate with social media platforms would go away if you, say, like, distributed the creation of that platform and took away the profit motive. But it still might possibly be a step in the right direction. So we were asking about this, and several listeners got in touch to name a few things. One is Keith, who's a data scientist and software developer. He mentions a few platforms that are open source or nonprofit social media platforms. Quote, "The main one I'd like to point out is Mastodon. This one has been gaining in traction and is pretty much a clone of Twitter. Some major differences are that it's open source, and they also encourage users to self-host, so you can use the code to have your own social media. The main site says that there are 320,000 users, which is not a large amount, but it is growing. I'd also like to note some more obscure social media. There are chat room social media platforms like Discord and Slack, where communities form. Two open source alternatives are Gitter and Rocket Chat. So I hadn't heard of those. I think maybe I'd heard of Mastodon, but I didn't really know what it was.
Mainly, I'm just familiar with the band, right. Which I don't think have any involvement in this at all.
We're a thrash metal platform.
Yeah, Mastodon, of course, local band. Occasionally, uh-huh. I'll run into folks from Mastodon at various events.
It's great seeing them around Atlanta. Yeah, yeah.
There was one band member in particular that, I'm not super familiar with Mastodon, but one of the members of Mastodon has like really cool sideburns, uh-huh. or has in the past.
Yeah,
and I would occasionally see him at different events. And I would like kind of look at him and I'd be like, hey, that guy's got some pretty good sideburns, you know? And I'm kind of like admiring his sideburns from afar. And then he'll kind of look back at me and there'll be like kind of a, not a look of fear, but a look of like, you know, like I'm staring at him, you know? And I'll,
oh no.
But, and I didn't put it together till later. Then I'm like, oh, he's in a famous band. And he thought that I was maybe like, you know, fanboying out and that I might approach him and, you know, disrupt, you know, whatever he's doing. And really, I was just admiring his sideburns. Anyway, for whatever that's worth. But I also admire their music. Let me be clear on that.
Oh, yeah. I think they are top-tier modern metal. Okay, so I think let's look at this next email from Sammy. This one came in after the Doppelganger Network episode. Sammy says, hey, guys, I just started listening to your new episode, The Doppelganger Network, and you brought up Capgras syndrome. I've never heard of it, and at first when you guys said that this famous French woman thought her loved ones were replaced by doppelgangers, I thought, how is this even possible? But as you started explaining it more, as when the face recognition part of our brain knows it's someone we know, but the feeling of familiarity does not arise, I started thinking, this is what I have. I was diagnosed with depression about 8 years ago and put it on an SSRI. But as I started my treatment and doing research, my dad and I came across a term called depersonalization. This is exactly what you described, when you know the person you see, but you don't feel the warmth of familiarity. In the first 2 years of my illness, I dealt with this probably about 90% of the time. It was horrifying seeing my parents, my friends, my boyfriend, and knowing I'm supposed to feel something, but I don't. Quite a few times I almost broke up with my boyfriend because I felt guilty that I didn't love him. At the peak of this, when I was with my therapist, I told her, "If you brought another man into this room and told me he was my dad, I'd believe you." Fortunately now, several years later, I rarely experience episodes like this. My last full-on depersonalization episode was about 2 years ago. However, to this day, I hold myself back from certain situations because I know that they have caused me to have these episodes in the past. Anyways, I felt immense gratitude when you guys mentioned this in the first part of the episode because this issue is something I find so hard to explain to people, but you guys and Sapolsky put it into the perfect words. I don't know if what I have dealt with is related to this syndrome, as I don't think people have been replaced, but I thought it was interesting. My official diagnosis now is panic disorder. Thank you for everything you guys do. You're one of the three podcasts I always listen to, Sammy. Well, first of all, thank you for sharing with us, but also mm-hmm. I'm really glad to hear you're doing better these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think as we try and stress on the podcast, you know, anybody out there, if you ever find yourself experiencing symptoms that we're discussing on the show, I mean, certainly there are dangers in self-evaluation, but don't hesitate to ask a professional about what you're feeling and to bring it to their attention.
Yeah,
I think that is always it's always a wise move. That's what they're there for, and they're the ones that can ultimately help you. Or tell you that if you are worrying about nothing, if you are, you know, self-diagnosing based on a podcast and jumping to conclusions, like they're the ones to rein you in on that as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, nothing good ever comes out of keeping stuff like this hidden. If mm-hmm. you are experiencing symptoms like this, it's important to talk to your loved ones about it, to seek professional help. These are not the kind of things that it's best to deal with on your own.
Right. Now, as for social media inducing symptoms like this on a more widespread scale, I mean, that's kind of new territory in some regards.
Yeah.
I wonder how the therapeutic world is currently, you know, adapting to all of this and how they will be adapting in the near future. Because, I mean, I look at my own experience with, say, Facebook, and I go on there. And I think what I experience some like level of just large scale depersonalization with everybody on there these days. I feel like I'm not encountering real versions of the people that I know or knew, and that I am not presenting a real version of the person I am. And it's weird and off-putting. And granted, some of this may be due to some of the research we've been doing. I mean, it certainly is a possibility. But I also think a large part of it is the platforms. Again, we'll hopefully be discussing more of this in future episodes of the show.
Yeah, totally. But also, I just want to say again, we're really glad to hear you're doing better, Sammy, and best of luck in the future.
All right, here's another one. This one comes to us from Kate. Hi, Stuff to Blow Your Mind. Recently listened to your episode about doppelgangers. At one point, you were talking about parasocial relationships and start listing some examples, but you completely forgot to mention the very medium you were using, podcasts. Sometimes I listen to podcasts more than I communicate with my friends, family, or even boyfriends. There was a time when I used to consider Ira Glass from This American Life like a brother, Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics like a father figure, and still to this day, you guys are like my friends. Interesting that this is based purely on personality and nothing to do with age. Stephen Dubner, 55 years old, is younger than Ira Glass, 60 years old. I have mentioned this to friends, and they have also revealed that they consider some of the podcast hosts they listen to like their friends. I would never consider these parasocial relationships as a negative because it genuinely enriches many of my face-to-face relationships. Thank you. Anyway, FYI, the Myths and Legends podcast did an amazing episode about people in real life who have experiences seeing their doppelgangers. Definitely worth a listen, and she includes a link, and I won't read the whole link, but basically the website is mythpodcast.com. So that sounds like a fun one to check out. Always happy to check out new podcasts, especially if they concern something like mythology.
Yeah. So I will try to give that a look if I find some time. But also, I have to report, I sometimes have a feeling like this. I mean, you can definitely, when listening to a podcast, start to feel like the people you're listening to are just your buddies, you know, especially if it's a conversational podcast.
Yeah.
I have had this experience plenty of times, I think. I guess the question about whether these count as parasocial relationships and whether or not they're destructive, I think, is a question of what role they play in your life. Because, I've also had the experience of listening to podcasts and sort of feeling when I'm listening to these people talk like they're my buddies. But I think it's okay because I don't find them like preventing me from spending time with my real friends or my real loved ones.
Right.
If I did find that it was like interfering with my relationships, I think I would be concerned then.
Yeah. Or, certainly I would be concerned if a listener showed up at my doorstep and wanted to borrow my Xbox or something.
Right. Yeah.
like that would probably be right.
I mean, also, it's important to have like realistic perspective and know that, while it can feel like you're being social with people when you listen to a podcast, of course, they're not actually your friend. You don't actually know
right.
each other.
Well, like Paul Kennedy, the host of Ideas, the CBC radio show. I've spoken about it on the show before because it's one of my favorites. And like I can catch myself kind of looking at Paul Kennedy kind of like a father or grandfather figure, especially since I don't really have any I don't have a real father or grandfather figure in my life anymore. So maybe I'm more inclined to find that in an individual from the podcast world. But I think it's ultimately like this particular example, like it's a healthy attachment.
Like you don't think you're actually going to go like meet Paul Kennedy or
right,
something.
Right. I know Paul Kennedy does not know me. And ultimately he's just this friendly voice that shares, wonderful topics with me via this medium of podcast. And I think it's a beneficial parasocial relationship if that is indeed what it is.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it to me, and I hope we can only be – if we are a parasocial relationship for anybody, I hope we can only be a beneficial one. Don't let our voices replace your real relationships with your friends and family. They're more important. Go talk to them about fatbergs.
Well, that's ultimately what I love to hear from listeners is when we've been able to turn you onto a topic and then you pick it up and you run with it or you take it out and you share it with people and and it becomes a conversation. It becomes at least a catalyst for you to then go out and interact with the world, interact with friends and family members, and make new friends, make new family members for that matter, if such is possible with some of our topics. I think that's ultimately the best case scenario for any episode that we put out there. Not that I don't think I've ever heard of anybody like actually acquiring a new family member through the show, but I would love to hear if anybody out there has ever met a significant other through listening to our show. I would absolutely love to hear about that.
Oh my God, yes, please send us your stories if that happened.
Yeah, maybe Fatberg is doing it right now. Somewhere out there, a love story is brewing through just strangers meeting and talking about the Fatberg episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
It's a romance between Soap Lady and Fatberg Cop.
Yeah, that would be the sequel, right?
Uh-huh.
Fatberg 2, Fatberg's in Love.
Look who's saponificating now.
There you go. All right. Well, hey, we have a whole stack of emails here that Carney, the mailbot, brought us. We were not able to read them all at all, but we did what we could. We read some of them. There are plenty that we read to ourselves and, you know, and we didn't read on the show. But hey, some of them we'll save for next time, and we encourage everyone to keep writing in. You have thoughts about episodes, you have corrections about episodes, you have criticisms, you have little tidbits to share. We love to hear from everybody. We'll share the email address here at the end of the show. Mm-hmm. You can also reach out to us. The main way, really, is if you go to the Facebook group associated with the show, which is the Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module. That's probably one of the better ways to interact with us these days. And, of course, StuffToBlowYourMind.com is the mothership. That's our O&O website, as they say. That's where you'll find all the episodes of the show and the various other bits of information that you might need.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison, and to our guest producer today, Maya Cole. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@StuffToBlowYourMind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hi, listener. I'm Carol Fisher, the host of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister. I'm so excited for you to hear the brand new season where we're uncovering a 35-year-old mystery. But for those of you who didn't hear season one or just want to listen to it again, you can now get access to all episodes of that first season of The Girlfriends 100% ad-free through the iHeart True Crime Plus subscription, which is available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. You'll also get access to every single episode of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, ad-free and 1 week early, only available to iHeart True Crime Plus subscribers. So what are you waiting for? Head to Apple Podcasts, search for iHeart True Crime Plus, and subscribe today.
Hey there. I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after.
On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.